Hey, y'all, it's me, Dr. Smita Ramon, Gyno Girl. Welcome back to another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. Today, I have a wonderful friend and colleague who has been on the show once before, I think 2 years ago, maybe, when I first started. Dr. Tammy Rowan, she's an associate professor of OBGYN at UCSF, the University of California, San Francisco, and her clinical practice focuses on caring for women with sexual health concerns and chronic illness, as well as GYN surgery and family planning services. Her research is focused on family planning and sexual health practices, both nationally and internationally. She's the current International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health president-elect, and I was a former educational chair and the former scientific chair, and has been a huge part of why I'm part of ISHWISH, so I always appreciate that. Welcome, Tammy, back to my...
Thanks for having me back. It's good to see you, even though it's been such a short time. I just saw you like less than 2 weeks ago at ISHWISH.
I know, and it was such a, I think, a fun time. I think people had a good time. We had a really, you know, huge conference this year in Long Island. Long Beach, sorry, in Long Beach. And I think we had close to 700 people registered, about 600, almost 600, that including the people that sponsored that were there, which is probably one of our biggest conferences, I think.
I think it was our biggest conference, and big congrats to you because you were the scientific chair for the meeting.
Oh, you really helped me a lot too. I was texting her mad every time someone canceled. Tammy, what should I do? Where should we go from here? So I think you're only as good as your scientific committee, honestly, is that we had a good committee this year. Well, let's talk about like some of the big things that happened. I mean, you're the ISHWISH president-elect, so congratulations on that. I'm super excited about you becoming the president in 2 years, I guess, right? Because Dr. Sally McFedrin is now. Talked a lot about research. We had the whole research symposium. Actually, let's talk about the research for a minute, because your mentees actually won the big Irwin Goldstein Award. So can we talk about some of the research that you guys did that brought this big award to the students and residents you work with?
Yeah, so it was a project that I led with a team of former medical students, current residents, and then another medical student. And so it had been a question I had actually been curious about for a long time, which is, are there sexual changes after a gender-affirming hysterectomy? And mm-hmm. So we would extrapolate a lot of the data. People oftentimes ask about hysterectomy. It's the most common procedure in the United States, actually, in terms of surgery. Mm-hmm. And so we have a lot of data looking at sexual function in the cis population. And you have to remember that people are getting hysterectomies because of fibroids or abnormal uterine bleeding or pelvic pain, which is very different than what the transgender and gender non-binary population is seeking care for. So they're really getting a hysterectomy really to align their body with their gender. They sometimes do have pelvic pain. We figured that out actually in our study, and I've seen it clinically for years. And so I was super curious about this question. And several years ago, I had, you know, some incredible students who were interested in sexual medicine who wanted to work on this project. And so we designed the study and I recruited from my clinic, and they followed these patients out for up to a year. So they tested them pre-procedure and asked them all kinds of details about not just their sexual practices, but what gives them an orgasm, and then different aspects of their sexual health, as well as their demographics, you know, other types of medical problems. And then we were able to survey them actually for several months up to a year after. And what's so exciting about this project is that we had been presenting this data at ISHWISH for the last 2 years. We had our baseline data 1 year, we had 3 month data another year, we had 6 month data, and then we finally had this up to 1 year data. And that, you know, previously we were just presenting with posters. And this time we got a podium. And not only were we on a podium, we were on like the main program session. Yeah. We changed it this year to put the top five abstracts on the podium for the entire meeting. And then it was actually the best abstract of the meeting. So they won an award for it. And it's so amazing. This beautiful, beautiful experience, because the students who did it are now residents, and so they were able to come. Yeah. And then we had a current student who really kind of sailed the ship home and was getting most of the last 9 to 12 month data and helped us put it together, and she was there and was presenting as a second year medical student to win this award in front of 500 people.
It was pretty amazing. And I think there's so many people didn't even know you get awards for ISHWISH. They're like, what, people get awards? And I was like, yeah, something to look forward to. So it was
great. There were a lot of awards given out, and the president gave out like five different awards.
I didn't even realize half of them were coming. So yeah, it was a nice, I think, a moment there. And there's tons of great abstracts, I think. Was there anything else that stood out for you when you were thinking about some of the abstracts?
I think, you know, the top five were all really interesting. And I think what really struck me about the top five was that they were almost all exclusively focused on sexual pleasure. There was one that was, you know, looking at kind of ET distribution and in a general area, which to me was really, if you looked at any provider, I was like, you could look at PTs, you could look at plastic surgeons, you could look at dentists, and you would find that they would be kind of concentrated in wealthier areas. And I think we saw that with physical therapists. But I thought what was so exciting was that in most of those abstracts, we were talking about sexual pleasure and orgasm, and in things that we don't oftentimes think about with sex. You know, we were always taught sexual and reproductive health is really about prevention, right? We're preventing pregnancy. We're preventing sexually transmitted STDs, infections. I hear that all the time, that people are like, that's what sexual health is. And I'm like, no, it's not actually. In this wish, we don't spend a lot of time talking about it. There's a lot of societies that can do that. We're here to talk about pleasure. And that was what I got out of from a lot of the abstracts, which I thought was really important.
That's a really good point. And not even talking about, like, usually you have some new pain stuff or, you know, but this was like really just like what's bringing pleasure to these patients, which is really cool. I like that a lot as well. So there were also some abstracts about like social media and menopause education. I think that was one of your students as well, right?
Yeah. So we had a couple posters. One that I thought was really neat that was looking at TikTok influencers and menopause content. And so if you look at the top 10 influencers in terms of menopause, only one of them is actually a physician, and less than, you know, 8% talk about anything related to sexual health in menopause, which I think really highlights this need, because sexual dysfunction absolutely peaks in menopause. It should be at the top of the list of things that people are talking about. I think people are excited about it. And I'm not, you know, schooled enough in social media to wonder is it because it's hard to get sex talked about on social media? The algorithms don't, you know, feed it really well, but that's my suspicion, because to me it would be a total hit if people actually talked about the high rates and the different treatments.
I agree. Now, I think there's a lot to do with the algorithms too, because there's a lot of, you get sort of lost in, they don't put you up front when you talk a lot about sex, or, you know, some of the, you say vagina too much or something, I don't know.
That's why I'm going to be behind in the feeds for people looking at my accounts.
All right. You guys have to just look for Tammy Rue and then you'll get all the good education. Okay. So as president-elect, you know, what do you think makes Ishwish 2026? How are you going to look toward the future? What do you hope to change? What do you hope to bring about? What do you hope to grow in this organization?
So I think there's a lot of things that we have going for us right now. There's a lot of momentum and interest in sexual health. And what's special about ISWISH is that we really talk about quality of life in a way that I think is different. And people are hungry for this content. Mm-hmm. You know, the questions that we answer are the ones that most people coming out of training and taking care of women are just not able to answer. These really critical quality of life issues. And really, I'm an OBGYN, right? And everything in OBGYN really does oftentimes boil down to sexual health, not all the time.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of sex involved in what we do.
Right.
And what's lovely about ISWISH is we really focus on that piece of it, you know? And so what I think we have going for us is that people are more interested in talking about sex, and they're looking for content of being able to answer the questions that people are asking. The special thing about ISWISH is it is just incredibly multidisciplinary. So, you know, we have basic scientists who are doing the lab studies with animals, looking at conditions like vulvodynia and sexual health behaviors. We have, you know, internal medicine doctors who are really, they're very focused on menopause and the menopausal changes that happen. We have social science researchers who come to our meetings, and we have a lot of psychologists and mental health providers who are there. And so there's just nothing like it. You know, if you look at any other society, And there's a lot of other societies, and I'm not here to knock other societies, but you'll oftentimes see that they're very dominated by one particular group. And even within that, you're dominated by physicians. Like, it's not even what type of physician, it's physicians. Whereas we have a lot of, you know, advanced practice practitioners, we have a lot of psychologists, we have a lot of MDs, we have a lot of DOs, we have a huge range. It's just an incredibly diverse organization.
That's what I love about it. And I think that's why we get so many people from so many parts of the country, because they really do, they feel at home. I think that's what people say, that Ishwish feels like home to them. So I love that about it.
Yeah. I mean, my hopes for it is, I think that we have so many people coming from the community. I think it's really interesting that we have so many of the people that are really speaking out on social media and promoting a lot of health related content. We also have a lot of people from academia, and my goal is to make it a home for all of them. Like, I'm not interested in having controversy amongst, you know, what an expert actually means. I want the people who are doing the research and the people in academia to feel comfortable and at home and welcome. And I want the people who are not doing the research, but maybe communicating the research and out there speaking and writing books, to feel like they have a home as well. I think we can be a really open, all-encompassing organization that way. And that's really my hope, especially as someone who really straddles, you know, mainly the academic world, but very much understands the role of, you know, communication and getting the information out to the masses.
Absolutely. I think that's great. What do you think, like, excited you the most about this year's sort of agenda from 2026 when you looked at the program?
I think that what was really neat about the program is that we were exposed to kind of more experimental, and this is a plus and a minus, right? Like, there were topics, like there were, you know, these sessions on, like, you know, pelvic venous disorders and alternative ways of thinking about, you know, breast conserving therapies. Like, these are not, you know, necessarily genital straight sex focused topics, but they are topics that we think about in all the patients that we see. If you're a sexual medicine expert, you become a pelvic pain expert. And so it's really helpful for us to think about, okay, these patients that we just aren't getting better, are there other modalities, other explanations for their pain, other treatment options that could be out there, you know, for them? And then it's really pushing the needle on these kind of new experimental treatments and things that are out there. I loved having the international speakers come. We talked about pornography, you know, and how people use pornography in various ways. We had some really nice sessions on just updating guidelines. So we learned about the new genital urinary syndrome and menopause guidelines that the AUA published. I always find it, you know, that those guidelines are so interesting. I declined being on the guideline committee because I was like, oh, it's AUA. I'm an OBGYN. Why would this matter?
Yeah.
And it's really neat how AUA does things that ACOG doesn't do in terms of the thoroughness.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize it ahead of time, you know, and how well thought out and how important it is, because we don't even have a guideline for GSM in obstetrics and gynecology. But I think it's because, Samina, I think it's because it's just what we do. Like, it never was a question to give everybody vaginal estrogen.
Yeah, that's
why
true.
Would we have a guideline on it? Like, that was always our primary prevention for recurrent UTIs.
Right.
It was always our treatment for menopausal symptoms. So I just think it wouldn't have occurred to anybody that we need a guideline on that. We're so comfortable with it.
That's true too, yeah. But I think, you know, some of these OBGYN groups that I'm on Facebook, people get very triggered by the fact that, like, it's not the OBGYNs that are, you know, kind of leading the way on that capacity in some ways.
I mean, I think we just take some things for granted. I mean, there's certain conditions that the, you know, these wonderful urologists that are out there are naming that we, you know, genital urinary syndrome of lactation. We all knew that existed, but it's literally never been published, you know, until Dr. Rachel Rubin and got a team of people, and she's a urologist, to publish this thing. And I'm like, how come we never even described this thing that we've been treating for so long, right? We just, we're,
Yeah, that's true. We've always been having some, just take a little dial or whatever. Yeah, it's very true. Well, I mean, I'm glad those guidelines are available because, you know, with the amount of women in menopause and experiencing it from all...
Well, we needed a guideline. Yeah. I mean, I just think, again, this is something that I think in obstetrics and gynecology, we've taken for granted that we need to start naming things and guiding people on how to manage them.
That's very true. We don't have that many, actually. I feel like we have these ACOG...
We have a ton of practice bulletins, right?
Yeah.
So we have committee opinions. But I would argue that they're, I mean, we have such a big range of things that we see in obstetrics and gynecology. So it's probably just the things that you and I are focused on that we don't see a lot of guidelines on that would be really valuable for us.
That's true. That's true. Because obviously, you're right. Even though everything we do is around sex, there's very little about sex other than what happens after you have sex or when you can't have sex or whatever the case may be. There was, I think, one of the hottest topics, you know, still going around is really around testosterone. You did a great, you know, kind of instructional course, on that with Dr. Sharon Parrish. Why do you think testosterone is so controversial in women's health?
I mean, I think the main issue is we don't have a product for women, right? So if you don't have an FDA-approved medication for women, it is incredibly confusing to figure out how and why you should use this medication.
Right.
I think that, you know, there's a lot that we would like to treat that happens to us in perimenopause and in menopause. And there's a lot of things that the traditional hormone therapies, the estrogen is really the main one we use. We use progesterone mainly to protect the uterus, though I will always argue it does more than that, and it plays other important roles in the body. But there are still these, you know, lingering other symptoms and conditions and concerns that people have. And we know that the ovaries also make testosterone. And so it's very easy to say, well, if we're giving people back their estrogen and their progesterone, why would we not give them back their testosterone? And I very much understand that question. Mm-hmm. But what I'm seeing more of is most people coming in saying, should I be on testosterone?
Right, right.
And I'm like, why should you? Because someone told me I should be. And I'm like, we don't tell anybody they should be on anything.
Right,
I mean,
right.
We do it now, I would say, to an extent, like, we're telling people that everyone should be on vaginal estrogen, but I'm actually of a different mind. I don't think anyone should be on anything.
Right.
I think that we need to individualize it according to, you know, what people's symptoms, priorities, values, concerns are whenever we talk about any treatment.
Right.
And so I'm not a shoulder, yeah. Right? I'm just like, you tell me what your symptoms are, what you're concerned about, what your goals
right.
are, and then we can talk about
yeah.
it.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think that's really precision medicine at the end of the day, which is what we kind of, you know, it's not all, you know, one size.
Yeah, we do. But I understand the hype around testosterone, yeah. you know, and I've been speaking about this a lot. I think testosterone has a lot of value. Mm-hmm. But I think that, to be really honest, we need to look at, you know, this idea that we have to give it to people because they're in menopause mm-hmm. isn't based on physiology, right?
Right?
Your body
right.
doesn't know from a testosterone perspective that it's in menopause.
Right. It doesn't
people who are It doesn't. It starts to go down in your 30s. It's lower, mm-hmm. right? People in their 40s are going to have a lot lower testosterone than they had when they were in their 20s. Mm-hmm. Whether or not it's causing the various symptoms that we see people have in perimenopause, I think is very up for debate and very individualized.
Right.
And then the question becomes, so, you know, it doesn't mean you shouldn't treat people, but we're not treating, I'm also of the mind that we're not treating a deficiency,
right?
I think that if a deficiency is when you look at all people and you see that there's a group that are in the middle, there's a group that are high, there's a group that are low. Every single person in their 40s and 50s is going to be on the lower end of the spectrum in terms of testosterone, right? So to say that they're testosterone deficient doesn't actually really fit the definition of a deficiency. Now, whether or not they would get better with testosterone treatment is a different question.
Mm-hmm.
That's testosterone is therapy. So this is just my approach. I don't, you know, begrudge anyone who has a different approach. My approach is we stop talking about that we're treating deficiencies and we start talking about that we're treating individuals with a therapy that has a goal.
Right.
And so the issue with testosterone, there was a fabulous lecture by Jim Faust at
ISWISH
that actually showed that estrogen and testosterone do very similar
mm-hmm.
things in the
that
body.
That was so good.
Very similar things in the body. And we got to be real about that. And not only do they do similar things in the body, but testosterone turns into estrogen.
Right.
So if you give people testosterone, is it that they are converting it into estrogen and then getting some of those beneficial effects potentially?
Right.
And so that's where this question of testosterone comes in. Now, there are plenty of people, if you add in testosterone, they will say that my energy is better. I feel like my lean muscle mass is better. My mood is better. Those are all real. And I'm not here to deny anyone having those experiences.
Mm-hmm.
But what we talked about in my educational course is if you take a group of people and you give them testosterone and you give another group placebo, you don't see a difference.
All right.
So if you want to go based on the data, right, the evidence that this treatment is better than placebo, we don't, and it's not an absence, right? People are like, oh, we don't have the data because no one did the study. No, the studies have been done. We don't have the data because the studies didn't show a benefit because the placebo effect is so strong.
Right.
But as I talk about, if someone comes to me and says, I started taking testosterone or I want testosterone, I give it to them and they report all of these benefits, I'm not going to tell them that that's not real, you know, that they should not take the medication.
Mm-hmm.
If they feel good on it without side effects, I think that that is their choice. But what we talked about in the course is that we need to be really honest about what data we have. Do we have long-term safety data on, you know, how and why people are using it? We don't. And I am someone who is not as scared of that. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of treatments we give people that we don't have long-term safety data on. Right. But the best part of the course to me was Dr. Sharon Parrish as an internal medicine doctor who has a lower level of risk tolerance because she takes care of cardiovascular disease issues and blood clots and things that I don't really take care of as an OBGYN. Mm-hmm. And then on the extreme, I just want to say it over and over again that we keep giving trouble to the oncologists for being scared of these treatments. Well, their level of risk tolerance is way lower, and it should be. Mm-hmm. Because they're taking care of people who are dying of hormone-sensitive cancers. Yeah. And so them not wanting to take the risk of giving a medication that could potentially exacerbate or increase that risk, they have every right to be afraid of that. I'm not going to criticize them for that. And so I think that was really my takeaway, that I love teaching this course and thinking about, like, this is where the data is. Mm-hmm. This is why we do things. This is why if you go to a different provider, you're going to get different levels of advice and concern because different providers have different levels of risk tolerance and ease with uncertainty.
Right. No, it's so true. And I think, you know, it does depend on, you know, the amount of experience you have with it and what you've been seeing with it. And, you know, because there's definitely patients that, like, I've had a patient get a blood clot on vaginal estrogen and there's no way she should have gotten that, you know, like.
No, and I've had patients that got recurrence of their breast cancer on vaginal estrogen. And those are patients that are never going to take it. And they have every right to not want to take it. And I think it's really hard for them to hear over and over again how it's totally safe for them and how they should be on it. Because that is not the case for everybody, right? There are people who have weird things happen and may not want to take these medications, and they shouldn't be told that they need to.
Exactly. And I think it just goes to show, you know, hormones are only as strong or potent as the receptors that are dealing with, that they're interacting with, right? And at the end of the day, we don't know the receptor, you know, status of everyone that's using these hormones. And so I didn't say that example to scare anyone from using vaginal estrogen. It's just that there are these outliers that we see that make people think twice. And, you know, the majority, every other patient I've had has been great on vaginal estrogen and they do wonderful on it. But you sometimes you think about like the one out of 1500 that you have and you're like, oh, that was weird. I wonder why.
Well, I think that speaks to this idea of clinical experience on multiple different levels, right? I've seen people, you know, I've always been someone who's like very guidelines based and, I don't believe in over-screening, for example, right? Like, I think that this, and this is just a different approach. Right. You know, like, I'm not somebody who's going to be over-screening looking for cancers that are, you know, we're unlikely to find or we're more likely to get a false positive. But there are other people who very much err on the side of, I would rather have, you know, hundreds of false positives.
And you can Prenovo, Galleria,
Exactly. And you can see this, you know, and this is just, again, our level of, you know, risk tolerance. If you look at the data on mammogram screening, if you do a mammogram on every woman starting at age 40, you will find more cancer and you will save about 10 lives, maybe in 10,000, at the expense of hundreds of extra cancer diagnoses that were clinically insignificant.
Right.
And there are going to be people who will take that information and say, it is absolutely worth hundreds of people being told that they have cancer that actually was clinically insignificant, would not affect their quality of life or life expectancy, to save those 10 or less than 10 people. Right. And I very much understand why they would say that. And there's other people who would say those hundreds of people who are now going to get surgery and chemo and radiation and all the sequela of that, you know, for an unnecessary cancer diagnosis, it's not worth it to save those 10 people. These are two truths. Right. Yeah. And this is like, this is just the reality of medicine and how we practice. And I want to make space for the fact that people.
Quick reality check. If you're listening to this and thinking, why does no one ever talk to me like this in my doctor's office? That's because most doctors aren't trained to, nor do they have the infrastructure for. That's why I started the GYN and Sexual Medicine Collective, my new concierge practice where sexual wellness, hormone health, and gynecology actually come together like they're supposed to. No 10-minute visits, no gaslighting, no have a glass of wine, relax. Just evidence-based, shame-free care for women who are done settling for bad sex, brain fog, hot flashes, or feeling invisible. I'm proud to be part of the Ms. Medicine Network, which means your care is rooted in science, not stigma. Find us at www.thegsmcollective.com and book the kind of appointment you wish you had had years ago. Your body called. It wants its power back. Let's go.
People really take that level of risk and uncertainty and risk and benefit and come out with a totally different conclusion. There is, mm-hmm. It is not black and white. Nothing we do is black and white.
Yeah. And nothing is without risk at all, right? Like, I think that's what people don't recognize is that anything, you know, all medications have some risks and some side effects and some. And so to think that, like, you know, you're going to take something and it does nothing to you on it that's negative is not entirely true for most people.
Yeah, it's a great thought. You know, yeah. I mean, I will say, you know, testosterone is so interesting because those of us, I've been, you know, I know testosterone is all the hype, but there's a lot of us that have been doing it for a long time before long it was time. Hyped, yeah. right? So yeah. Yeah. I've been prescribing testosterone for, you know, over a dozen years to, you know, a lot of people. You know, you're in an insurance-based system. I mean, I see a lot of patients. I've been giving out a lot of testosterone. And the results I get are different, I would say, than a lot of the hype. And it's not because I'm a bad doctor. I'm giving them the same treatment. You know, mm-hmm. I think that I think there's, you know, I have some patients who do fabulously on testosterone and they're doing great and I keep them on it. I have other patients who have no effect and I have other patients who have side effects and negative side effects. So I've got a very, you know, balanced view of where I see the pros and cons. And so I think that this is really individualized. Everything we do, that's the problem with hormone therapy is that because it's been so undertaught for so long, we want to kind of get people up to speed real quick. And so we give them like algorithmic medicine. We say that everyone should be on this dose and should be doing it this way. And it's like, it's just not, that's not how I practice.
Yeah.
And I think this is part of the problem in medicine in general.
Mm-hmm. It's really not an algorithm, and that's when AI is going to take over. It's going to be a real problem.
AI is going to take over. It's going to be really.
It's going to be automated.
Yeah, it's a problem. I mean, there's a lot you could put in there, but I just like I don't know how AI is going to talk. You know, be able to figure out people's values. You know, like that's what I say. Like, what's your priority? What symptoms are we trying to treat? What symptoms are you trying to avoid? I mean, I guess you could plug it into a computer, but humans are different. They're going to respond differently to different medications.
Absolutely. And I guess that's the end, you know, the end of it is really that you and I both have experience in this. And so I can totally understand everything you're saying in terms of there are some people who tell me they see color for the first time when they take testosterone. And other people are like, well, when am I supposed to feel something? Like, when is this going to happen? And I'm like, you may not. And that might be a reason. And then the other people that come in with chin hair, even though they're on the lowest possible dose.
They're on vaginal testosterone and they're getting chin hair and acne. And I'm like, it's like, how is this? Like, what? But it happens.
And then they stop it and it stops.
It stops. Yeah. I mean, it was so weird. Yeah, exactly. On a one-tenth of the systemic dose. Okay. You know?
Yeah.
And they didn't have acne when you were teenagers. And you're just like, I don't get it, but okay. Yeah.
Or the ones that, like, your levels didn't even bump at all, and they all of a sudden lost hair from it. And you're like, what? Like, what is happening?
Well, it goes to show, we talked about that a lot in the course, that this is the level issue is, you know, I talk about this a lot. I know people really want their hormones tested. I know people promote it and say that I'm just denying people care. But the hormone testing is really, really problematic. It is wildly imprecise, inaccurate, both.
Yes.
And doesn't really give us always a lot of clinical information. And this is the other part about treating with testosterone is that a lot of the benefit that people are getting, they're seeing at really high levels of testosterone.
I know.
And so, you know, not this goal of physiology. But when I started, you know, doing more research, even when we looked at studies that gave testosterone transdermally and we pretend it was at a physiologic dose, it was not. It was a patch. There were three patches that were tested, 150, 300, 450. And they found that overall the best benefit was in a 300 microgram patch. A lot of those people had super physiologic levels because we weren't treating them to a level. We were treating them to a dose. And so we have to be really real about that. And so instead of this idea to me of, oh, they're deficient, I'm going to get them up to their level when they were in their 20s, I look at it a little differently. And I say, look, a lot of these people are getting super physiologic levels and we don't have long-term data, even if they were at physiologic, but we certainly don't have about super physiologic. And so this is less to me about like replacement or physiologic dosing. And let's just be real that testosterone is a performance enhancing drug. If you're taking it at these higher levels, that's what it's doing. And that's not passing judgment. That's just honesty. Right? Yeah. Like we know that men, it's controlled substance for a reason. Men take it because it builds muscle mass. It's a trophic medication. If you take it at high levels as a woman, you're going to build muscle mass. If you take it at physiologic levels, so the levels you were at when you were in your, 20s, that hasn't been shown to build muscle mass. So, people like this idea, like, oh, I need to take it to build lean muscle mass. Just work out, like work out a lot, not work out a lot, but like lift weights. It will not, it's not going to harm you. Will it benefit you? Maybe, but the data doesn't show that if you replace it physiologic levels for lean muscle mass production, it's going to make a difference.
Right. No, that's true. And I think when you do get, I definitely have patients who sit at like 100, 150 and they feel much better if I drop, and if they drop too low, it's like, wow.
Yeah. And the guidelines say you're supposed to drop them. And I'm like, why would I do that? They're not having any side effects. Oh, because we don't know the long-term effects. I don't know the long-term effects of them at physiologic ranges either, right? That's we have no long-term studies on, putting someone at a level of 50 when they're in their 50s. Like, we don't have any of that because that's not our physiologic body. Our physiologic body did not sit at 50, for 20 years.
Yes.
It's been sitting at 10. And so none of this is actually, this idea that this is evidence-based. I'm like, no, it's not. It's guideline-based. And the guidelines are, based on the best available evidence we have. But when you spend time with the testosterone data, I start throwing out this idea of evidence-based, because the evidence is all over the place.
Yeah, that's true too. I mean, I guess that goes to show, with that 300 microgram patch, that was supposed to be FDA approved.
I think it got
approved in England, right? Or London?
It was approved abroad. And, it showed benefits. It showed benefit in terms of desire and satisfying sexual events. So we know that testosterone is better than placebo in those studies. But we don't want to admit that the reason we don't have an FDA-approved product is because when a company tried to study it as a gel in the way that we give it to people in a 1% gel, that product did not do better than placebo. It was equal to placebo, right?
Yeah.
But we still recommend using it as a gel, even though the best data that we have is on a patch that isn't approved or a gel that wasn't better than placebo. So I'm not interested in people telling me that like the guidelines are all evidence-based anymore, because it's based on all the information that we have. We know we have the patch data. We know that when we give people testosterone in a lot of other studies, and we know it anecdotally that they're doing better. But when they did a randomized controlled trial with an actual product, it wasn't better than placebo. So let's just be real that was group data, but I'm sure there were individuals in that group that saw a huge benefit. And so if that's my patient, I'm not going to take it away from her.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's oftentimes what you hear is like, if you tell a patient who has low desire, they start feeling better and like, cognitively I feel much better, but I don't feel more desire at 6 months. Are you going to take my testosterone away? I'm like, no.
That's what the guidelines tell you to do. And this is where, Dr. Parrish was on the guidelines. I know the people who wrote the guidelines. I respect them. I respect everybody who, and I'm just saying we are allowed to have differences of opinion.
Right.
And we are allowed to talk about where there's uncertainty. And I give space for them making those recommendations that they would say, well, you should be off of it because you're not getting the benefit that we prescribed it for. That's legit. Yeah. I just practice differently.
Right. Exactly. I think that you and I are in the same in that respect. What do you think the biggest myth around testosterone? Do you think that's probably the biggest myth is that it benefits?
Yeah, I think the myth is. I mean, but again, if you tell somebody it's going to do all these things, it's going to be much more likely to do that than if you tell somebody that the data doesn't show that it's better than placebo.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. No, you're right.
So this is where this is the study that we really need to do is take 50 women. Tell them it's going to do it. Take another 50, tell them what the data actually shows, and then see what the difference is. Like
that's that's true. I wonder if that will happen ever. Probably not. So that was a good instructional course. And then we had some instructional courses around, complex genital pelvic pain that was done. I think that one actually made a lot of sense to some of us that are treating some of these really complex PGAD patients and general pelvic patients. I do think some people thought it was a little bit above their, you know, like they haven't seen the patients with it. And so it didn't make, you know, they felt, you know, some of that.
It was a pretty advanced course.
It was pretty advanced. But it was, to me, I felt like a lot of it made sense. Unfortunately, I feel like we don't have, you know, a lot of extra steps we can take with some of these things other than centrally acting.
Well, that's one of the issues that I think came up even for the main sessions, right. You know, for the pelvic venous disorders and for the, you know, potential nerve sparing breast reconstruction is, you know, we're those of us not, you know, in these locations and those of us without very resourced patients, we're not going to be able to access these, you know, levels of care that other people are doing for these experimental treatments. And I think that's something that it's not, you know, we should be talking about in scientific meetings. We talk about experimental treatments all the time. I think ISWISH gets criticized for, quote, not being evidence-based, right. Even though at most scientific meetings, people are talking about new and experimental things.
Right.
We also have to be very real about where the funding is. We learned, I mean, my takeaway from the meeting, the best talk by far was Dr. Anderson and Kiesner's talk about funding and showing, you know, where we're placing funding. And my biggest takeaway was that vulvodynia, the entirety of a year's budget at the NIH, $4 million goes to vulvodynia and $800 million goes to breast cancer. And I am not here to knock the importance of breast cancer research. There are zero treatments for vulvodynia. Zero. A $4 million grant is one grant to, you know, a one, what we call an R01, right? That's one multi-year study. Research is expensive. I know it's hard for people to understand that. It is incredibly expensive, but the entirety of vulvodynia research would fund one multi-year study, you know, from one investigator. That's why we have no treatments. There is no funding going into it. And so then people criticize us for not having science. And I'm like, well, you know, I can't be a breast cancer symposium.
Right. There's literally no money.
Or people criticize us for having more relationships with industry. And I'm someone who has a lot of ethical concerns about conflicts of interest.
Sure.
You know, you hear me talk about this in our meetings all the time.
Right.
I'm very hard not to have conflicts of interest for multiple different reasons.
Right.
And yet in sexual medicine, the only people funding it is industry. And I would also argue it's so few industries that it makes conflict of interest look bigger. Whereas if you go to other societies, there are so many companies in there that it dilutes it out that everybody has a million different conflicts or are speaking for companies.
It's so true.
You know?
It's so true. It's like the big cancer ASCO. You know, it's always here in Chicago. It's like a block away from my house. We have like 50,000 oncologists that, you know, are in, and then so much industry, like the whole city is like one bear, blah, 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 you know? And it's like, we have none of that. We have like two or three people and they struggle. It's not like, you know, like Daré Pharmaceuticals, you know, some of the other pharmaceuticals out there, they have so little money, actually. They don't.
Yeah, no, they're all really short. Yeah, it's funny. I have a good friend who's a cardiologist and he went to a cancer conference and he was describing like he's just the billions of dollars of pharma. And I was like, but you're a cardiologist, right? Like, it's like, I would give anything to have what cardiologists have at their meetings, right? But it's the hierarchy of where money is in here is really problematic. But again, you know, if you are someone or you know someone, you know, with cancer, you're going to want that money to go there.
Of course.
You know, so I really understand that we have finite resources. But sexual medicine, very
finite. And that was the big take-home point in Dr. Anderson and Kiesner's lecture. And it was really compelling, I think, that even the amount of research got cut in the last, 24 months or less than that, 12 months even, that so much research got cut.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, you know, you can't even do certain types of research because you can't name certain, you know, genders or, you know, groups.
Yeah.
And so it was really really compelling and quite sad, actually. It was really quite sad.
It was very
sad. But it was, I think it was a good wake-up call for a lot of people. A lot of people really woke up from that.
Yeah.
I thought, let's talk just for a few minutes about the symposium on body image. I thought that was pretty interesting as well. We had someone talk about sort of body image when it comes to sexual function, as well as, and this was all in the world of oncology, actually. So it was basically an oncology symposium. What do you think your take home points from that? Where we had someone talk about body image from a psychology perspective. We had a breast cancer reconstructive surgeon who talked about, Dr. Anna Paled, who talked about nipple sparing surgery, which I guess is not as... Nerve sparing surgery, yeah. And then, what was the other one?
Oh, we had a PT.
Yes, talk about lymphedema, which is really cool too. Yeah. So what do you think the take-home message is that you kind of went away with on that?
You know, it was really interesting. I'm someone who's been doing survivorship since I was at the beginning of residency. I've published on survivorship work. So I've been doing this for a long time. And I think that I didn't, and I sometimes don't fully appreciate what breast cancer surgery does to my patients. Mm-hmm. You know, I saw someone recently who really stuck with me because she was someone who her reconstruction had a complication, mm-hmm. and she basically lost the breast and it can't be reconstructed. And she didn't have breast cancer. She actually had like a precancer. Mm-hmm. And so, so there's like an extra layer, yeah, of like, you know, everybody assuming she had cancer when she didn't, even though it was precancer. Yeah. And, you know, and I've been sitting with this, and that was just this year. I mean, I've seen lots of people with different types, yeah, of reconstruction. And so my takeaway was that I think that those of us who do survivorship, at least I know me, I'll just speak for me, didn't fully appreciate what this does to people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've been doing it, the Iswich Fall course, for a long time. We've been doing these OSCEs, these kind of like practice interviews. Yes. And one of the cases that we use is a woman who had breast cancer surgery and is trying to explain to her partner how she doesn't have sensation in her breast anymore, you know, and how do you do that? Yeah. And, you know, so I've heard it, but I've never internalized, yeah, it to such an extent. And I really internalized it this, yeah, time in a way that I thought was really powerful and important, mm-hmm, because this is the most common cancer that women get. 1 in 8 women are going to get breast cancer. The vast majority of them are going to be getting these surgeries. The other takeaway that I thought was interesting was this, you know, idea between a lumpectomy and a mastectomy, which we talk about and see all the time, that there's so much data that lumpectomy, you know, with radiation is equal to a mastectomy, and in terms of outcomes of breast cancer recurrence, mm-hmm, and the outcomes of mastectomy in terms of sexual function and body image are just so bad. Yeah. So, and yet people still choose it. And that was really striking to me, of like, we have the data showing this isn't better. We have the data showing that your body image and your sexual function is going to be that, right, much worse. And yet
they still choose.
People are still making an informed choice. And I really kind of internalized that. And I was like, I totally get it. I would probably make that choice, yeah, too. Cause you'd be like, well, it's not that, you know, it's more important to me, especially if you're a young person. Right. Right. If you're a young person, to not have the level of screening, or say you had DCIS and you just don't want to risk this recurrence. Mm-hmm. But I think that I was really struck by just how obvious the difference is and how much worse these people do.
Yeah.
But again, people make choices. Right. I don't think that oncologists and surgeons aren't showing them the data. I think they are, at least in my institution. And I still see women over and over again choose mastectomy.
I mean, you think that everyone's talking... I think people are now talking more, at least the people that spoke with us were talking about sexual wellness after these procedures, but I don't know.
Yeah, I doubt oncologists talk about sexual wellness and body image, but I'm sure they do talk about outcomes in terms of breast cancer.
Sure, yeah.
And it's been known for a long time that lymphectomy plus radiation has the same
outcome. Yeah, that's true. That's true.
For many people. Again, I'm not an oncologist or a breast, right, surgeon. For many people.
Yeah.
For early stage, right, cancer. Right.
Yeah, I think that was very compelling too. And even the talk from the lymphedema physical therapist, you know, I think that was very interesting to hear the what she does for it, but also the amount of, you know, we all see patients who have that lymphedema after having their lymph nodes removed or dissected,
yeah,
but you don't think about the impact it might have on their like day-to-day sexual life, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was really interesting. Any last minute, you know, things that struck you from the conference that you hadn't thought about? I think, feel like we always learn something new when we go to Iswich. And so I feel like the POTS, you know, we had someone talk about Dr. Alexis Cushions, who had her on the,
yeah,
I've had her on the podcast talk about POTS, and I'm going to try to get Brooke Spencer to talk about yeah, pelvic venous insufficiency. So I think that was, you know, interesting, and we've all seen this connection. I to your point, though, it's hard to figure out who to send these patients to if you think that's what's might help them, because there's so few people that really know how to do it or take it seriously.
Yeah, I mean, I think my takeaway is that I think as a society and as a community, we have to think about how we speak to people who are just brand new. I mean, I knew so many people that were there when that were just brand new. And I always say, go to the fall
Yeah,
course
that's
because
good.
that's where you're going to get the bread and butter of what to do. What we do at our society meeting is different than I think other society meetings sometimes, where those of us on the scientific committee and in leadership invite people to speak to us as opposed to invite ourselves to speak to other people. Right. And
Yeah, that's true.
so
That's a
it's,
good
it,
point.
that's, yeah. And I think that that's, that is what we oftentimes do because there's more to learn and we bring people in. And what I'm always excited about with ISWISH is how many of these people in other specialties love coming to ISWISH and agree and, and get so much out of it and how we have, incredible attendance and people go to most of the sessions, even though it's exhausting. And, you think, okay, I'm full. Oh my God, I can't fit anymore. And then you still can. And so, that's really my big takeaway with ISWISH and with a scientific meeting. And so I think for us, we need to think about as leaders in the society, is making sure that we still, that's what, as the education chair, I always tried to focus the education courses on that common denominator of what people, of people who are kind of new. And then the scientific abstracts are like the, what are we going to learn? And then in the main sessions, thinking about how we strike that balance of like, let's review. And I thought we did a nice job this year. Like we reviewed the GSM guidelines. We reviewed the ICSM committee guidelines. We had, a speaker from Menopause Society. And we've had,
Talk about POI, and that was
we bring those in and then we have these really cool state-of-the-art or symposium on just, other abstract issues that we hadn't thought about and can learn from people outside the sexual medicine world. So that's kind of my takeaway. I think we strike a nice balance and we'll probably continue doing that. And then there's nothing like the networking. I mean,
That's fun.
incredible, wonderful reconnection. It's like the
Yeah, it really
family.
is nice. And I always tell people that too. I'm like, if you really want to learn the stuff, you need to come to the fall course because you might get overwhelmed with like the science. But it's always cool just to know what's happening in the world and like what's coming up in sexual medicine. Oh, the other interesting term that we learned was on digital intimacy and technoference, like how technology is very.
Yeah.
So just this is a takeaway for you guys. Technoference is causing a lot of problems in sexual health in our communities because technology
Well, it's why the rates of sex are lower than they've ever
everything.
been. People aren't having sex because they're on technology. You're getting your dopamine hit in other ways.
Absolutely.
It's really a
It's a big
problem.
problem actually. And so take some after you listen to this podcast, take some time.
I know. Listen to this podcast on your commute. Don't do
Don't
this
do it
late at night.
tonight.
Go have
Don't, you
sex.
know, spend time with your family, spend time with your husband, wife, whatever else person you might have in your life. But technoference is real. And I think we all can, like, I can speak to it. Like, sometimes, I have to, like, force myself away from all this stuff because it can consume you otherwise.
Well, again, like, it's all
It's all
dopamine.
dopamine. Yeah. So is sex. So there you go.
So it's like these companies have done a really good job at getting our dopamine
Yeah,
fixes done so people
absolutely.
aren't getting it in other ways.
Well, thank you, Tammy. I appreciate you coming on to talk about Ishwish and talk about our annual meeting that just happened last week. And now you're heading to Porto. I wish I was going, but it's too much for me to do
I know we'll miss you. It's too
now.
close together, but thank you so
Yeah,
much
of
for having me
course.
on. It's great to see you again.
Thanks for joining me today, guys. Remember, I'm here to educate so you
If
can
you have a
advocate.
second,
Please join
please
me next
subscribe to
week
this
on my next
podcast.
episode. I'd love for you to be a follower and learn as much as you can about the things that we're going to talk about with all the people on our journey. Please review us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. These reviews really help. Review us, comment, tell me what else you want to hear to get more information. My practice website is www.cgcchicago.com. My website for Gyno Girl is www.gynogirltv.com. My Instagram is Gyno Girl, so please follow me for some good content. Additionally, I have a YouTube channel, Gyno Girl TV, where I love to talk about all these things on YouTube. And please subscribe to my newsletter, Gyno Girl News, which will be available on my website. I will see you next time.